From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Iran struck back. Last night, Iran launched a dozen missiles at U.S. military installations in Iraq. President Trump took to Twitter last night stating, quote, "All's well. Missiles launched from Iran at two military bases located in Iraq. Assessment of casualties and damages taking place. So far, so good," end quote. But many woke up this morning feeling that deep, nervous shiver as the U.S. and Iran teeter on the edge of escalation. So we want to take a methodical, careful assessment of what the president's best options are now. This hour on Point, next steps between the U.S. and Iran. And you can join us. How did you feel when you woke up this morning and heard the news? What do you want the president to do or not do next? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Now, we're going to hear from several people this hour, a retired Marine who served in Iraq, a longtime Pentagon reporter, a former U.S. ambassador to Iraq, and from our first guest today as well. He's David Gergen. He served as White House advisor to Presidents Nixon, Ford, and Clinton. And he's a professor of, amongst those presidents, and he's a professor of public service and founding director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. David Gergen, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Meghna. It's good to be here.
So if you had the president's ear right now, how would you counsel him?
Walk carefully. Very, very carefully. Everyone is nervous today because both sides have an erratic quality about them, and we in the West find the Iranians mysterious. We have find them very hard to understand. We don't understand their value sets very well, and they feel, you know, we're the monster, we're the Satan. So I think both sides have almost paranoid views of each other, and that. And Iran is a much, much bigger country than Iraq. People forget that Iran has about four times as many people as Iraq does. This, you know, we got very mired down in Iraq. Just think how mired down we might get in Iran should this go badly. But I did. I must say, I woke up relieved this morning because we had not exchanges of the last 24 hours have been rather benign. They seem to be more about message sending than about trying to inflict serious damage. The Iranians, I think, are particularly anxious not to kill Americans. We had, as far as we can tell, no casualties reported so far. And there's a somewhat different tone coming out of the White House. We'll have to wait and see here in the next hour what President Trump has to say. But it was at least encouraging last night that we didn't have belligerents issuing from the White House.
Right. And just as you noted, Mr. Gergen, as we go to air now, the president hasn't yet spoken. He's scheduled to around 11 o'clock. Eastern time today. But, you know, to the point of President Trump's mindset right now, as you noted last night, he actually issued a tweet that had the intent of calming, I think. In the campaign, he was very adamant about campaigning against forever entanglements.
Right.
But at the same time, we have this all of a sudden in the past couple of days, this flashpoint now based on a decision that the president himself made. So where does that lead you to think that his mind is right now on Iran?
I think it's almost entirely unpredictable where he is and where he's going to go in the next 48 hours. It was only one of his strongest critiques of President Obama was that he drew a red line with regard to Syria, and when the Syrians then violated it, he did not act. This president, in the last 48 hours, has issued a warning to Iran that if it attacks at all, he's going to respond mightily. And now we've had the attacks from Iran, and yet he seems to be drawing back a little bit and showing more caution, which I welcome. But it also suggests to you that they don't know themselves from one day to the next where they're coming out. And I think that is what is in part what has several things can be said. I think a lot of Americans don't know whether – and people around the world don't know whether they can trust what the president says. That says he's going to do, or even how he describes the past, given his record of thousands upon thousands of misleading and fallacious stories coming out of the White House. We're all on edge about that. And here's where credibility really matters in a president. And when your credibility doesn't matter sort of day-to-day activity. Most people know that there's a lot of jostling goes on. But when you're in a crisis or near a crisis, credibility is everything. You know, John Kennedy wouldn't have gotten through 13 days mm-hmm. had he not been credible. And so that removes not only the capacity of the other side to believe in him, but I think it's also has dampened the public rallying. The American public has not rallied to President Trump over this. I saw a survey this morning that said 53% of the country now believes he's mishandled Iran. And 35% say, you know, they're intensely concerned about that, and they really think he badly mishandled it. That is so different from the normal dynamic when presidents get into conflicts. Normally, there's sort of a rally round effect, and everybody wants to help the president. Everybody cares about the country. And now we have this, what the hell is he doing to us? Is he really going to get us into a conflict or not?
Oh, so you said so many interesting things there, Mr. Grogan. Let me first ask
please,
you.
David, okay.
Because you mentioned the Cuban Missile Crisis. Mm. I actually was kind of turning over in my head this morning. Mm. The 13 days when the world felt it was on the brink of a potential nuclear conflict.
Yes.
We're not there yet, are
we're
we?
Not there, thank
we're not
goodness.
There yet.
I was in college. We were calling our parents. We had a car to drive to Canada in 13 days. It was a very, very scary moment. We're not there yet. I have some sense. I mean, the missiles that the Iranians use were ballistic missiles. They're more sophisticated, the most sophisticated they have, and yet they didn't do as much damage as one would have assumed.
Right. So tell us then how – I mean, you advised four presidents, Presidents Reagan, Nixon, Ford, Clinton. I'm sure there were many moments of extreme tension where you were in the room. How is it supposed to – I mean, every administration is different.
Yes.
I grant that. But – how is it supposed to work right now? Who's advising the president? Who has the president's ears?
Those are really, really good questions. And this, again, just as the past pattern of misleading the country so frequently is going to come back and haunt him now, the rapid turnover in people around him has left this president with what can only be called a second string, even a third string of talent. One good thing about the team that's now there, he has his fourth national security advisor. He has his third defense secretary, two secretaries of state. One good thing is there's much less infighting than we've seen in the past. When you had the heavyweights in the early part of the administration, there was more infighting. So that I think things are calmer. But frankly, the competence level has, if anything, seems to have gone down some. And we've had these sort of really sort of weird experience. Peter Baker writes about them in the New York Times today. And, you know, the fact that the Defense Department sent a letter and sent it to the Iraqis saying we're getting out. And then they come back and say, no, it was a mistake. We sent the letter. Mm. What? I mean, mm-hmm. that is unheard of in these kind of and normally in a crisis, you want to check and double check everything that happened. So you've got it right. You have to be very careful, very cautious. That's why going back to 13 days, it was so important that John Kennedy was not impulsive. If you think back in that crisis, the first coalition that formed, the first majority that formed among his advisors was to strike back and to obliterate Cuba. But Bobby Kennedy and others talked people back from that. They formed a new majority later on of restraint, and that saved us from what would have been a nuclear exchange. Mm. And it made a lot of difference. You know, 13 days is a classic case that you teach from on leadership because it shows the power of thinking carefully, surrounding yourself with the best people, having a really competent team, and then knowing what your objectives are. And let me come back to that last point, if I might, about the objectives. What's missing right now? We know, basically, the world can tell you what the Iranians want. They want the U.S. out of the Middle East. That's what the Shias in Iraq are looking for, and Iraq is split over this. But that's their objective. What is our objective here? I don't think anybody can tell you that. We haven't heard it from the White House. And that, again, also weakens your capacity to negotiate and to figure your way out of this.
What should our objective be?
Our objective should be stability, which allows every nation to feel that its population has an opportunity in life, that they have an opportunity to get good, decent jobs, that the place will not be as corrupt as it has been, that we won't have the kind of tensions. We should be a helpmate in developing a new Middle East. And instead, we're in grave danger of our influence diminishing sharply and the Russians and the Chinese filling that void.
Well, David Gergen, stand by here for just a second because we do have to take a break in just a bit. But before we do that, I want to bring in Brian Bender into the conversation. He is defense editor for Politico Pro. Brian, it's great to have you. Welcome back to On Point.
Nice to be here.
So what are you hearing from your contacts in the Pentagon? What's the feeling right now about what next steps might be?
Well, I think first off, there's a little bit of a sigh of relief in the wake of these Iranian strikes overnight at these two air bases in Iraq where U.S. troops are bedded down. And that's because it seems like there are pretty strong indications that the Iranians went out of their way to conduct these strikes, but to conduct them in a way where U.S. troops would not be killed. And I think a lot of people are reading that as a sign that this was kind of a face-saving effort by the Iranians to do something in response to the U.S. drone attack that killed the head of the Revolutionary Guard's Quds Force last week. Mm-hmm. But then it also opens up an opportunity for the temperature to come down a little bit. Obviously, if U.S. troops had been killed, I think the president would be under much more pressure to do something and do something very aggressively, which only would serve to escalate the crisis. So I think there is some relief today that there's an opening here for things to calm down a little bit.
But, Brian, hang on here for a second because I want to hear the second half of your thought. But we just have to take a quick break. So Brian Bender and David Gergen, stand by. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're taking a careful and meticulous assessment this hour of the possible next steps in the increasing tensions, between the United States and Iran. I'm joined today by David Gergen. He is the founder of the Center for Public Leadership, the director for the Center of Public Leadership at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He has served as White House advisor to four presidents, Presidents Reagan, Nixon, Ford, and Clinton. And Brian Bender also joins us. He's defense editor for Politico Pro. And Brian, before the break, you were saying that perhaps there's the room for a little bit of cooling off here. But then I had to cut you off when you said, but what?
But as David said, there's a lot of variables here that we can't predict over the coming days. I mean, even out of Iran today, we're hearing conflicting signals. The foreign minister has said some things that also seem to want to take the temperature down and find a way out of this crisis or past it, if you will. But then the Ayatollah is also saying things suggesting that Iran is not done yet in terms of retaliating for the killing of Soleimani. And obviously President Trump is also very unpredictable, so how he's going to react, is he going to feel pressure to do something about it? What makes this attack different, the Iranian attack overnight, is that it was not Shia militias supported, armed by Iran.
Right.
It was not proxy forces, which has primarily been what they've used to attack U.S. troops in Iraq and to do all kinds of other mischief around the region. This was an attack from Iran against a military base housing U.S. troops, and that makes it different. And so, I think there's still a lot of risk that this could escalate further, but it will all depend on what the leaders on multiple sides decide to do.
David Gergen, what do you think?
I think Brian's analysis is spot on. One thing I would suggest, Brian, is that there is another theory about why the Iranians in their response last night were more restrained than we might have expected. And that is that potentially they want to fake us out, that they want to this was their big hit. It wasn't very important. It's sort of a pinprick in some ways, the U.S. forces. But under this second theory, what the Iranians are doing are trying to make us more complacent, just step back, saying this isn't as big a deal as we thought, and that while they're planning a much more sophisticated attack for later on.
Brian, are you your response to that?
Well, I mean, I think it's certainly something that the Pentagon and the U.S. Central Command in that part of the world is planning for and has been planning for. We've been hearing this drumbeat of warnings coming out of the Pentagon from Defense Secretary Mark Esper about all of this intelligence, including intelligence before the attack on General Soleimani, that the Iranians were preparing to do all kinds of things to attack our forces, to the point where the U.S. is in the process of moving a lot of troops around Iraq to consolidate them into safer locations. So there's clearly a concern here that the Iranians have things up their sleeve. You know, obviously the big question is whether they're going to, how far are they going to push? How far are they going to go? How far do they think they can go without engendering, a tougher response from the U.S.? So it's a very dicey situation.
I agree with that absolutely, and we talk a lot because we're here in Americans in America about sort of incompetence or competence in the White House and what people are they're jumping around, and it's really hard to tell where they're going to come out. Well, that probably is taking place in Tehran too. I mean, you have to think about what's going on among their councils, they must have been very surprised by the way we took out Soleimani. That just didn't seem to be in the cards. They had we've had two presidents, George W., as well as Obama, who looked at that option about taking him out, and both decided against it. So the Iranians had every reason to be a little bit relaxed about that particular problem, and he was showing himself. He made himself very much a target when he landed at that airport. He was, he was pretty brave to go out there, and it shows a sort of bravado that they thought we've got these Americans pretty much where we want them for the moment.
Well, let's take a quick call here. Let's go to Marty, who's calling from Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. Marty, you're on the air.
Hi. Other than most Republicans, who in their right mind is going to believe what this guy says, that everything's under control? There could be dozens, hundreds of our soldiers that have perished. This guy wouldn't tell you. Wouldn't tell you that, being the businessman that he is. It's just, another day at the office. We kill them, they kill a few of our guys, everything's okay.
Well, Marty, thank you for your call. Brian, though, let me just turn to you with that, because as far as we can see thus far, both U.S. and Iraqi officials are saying there's no deaths from these attacks. Of course, different things have been said in the past 12 hours or so, but What are you hearing?
Yeah, I mean, from what we understand, these missile attacks, and it was nearly two dozen of them that were fired, and these are, just to sort of explain what these missiles are, I mean, these are not the most high-tech weapon systems out there. They're fairly rudimentary. They're not necessarily all that accurate. But we are hearing that they hit mostly Al-Assad Air Base, which is in western Iraq, where a large number of U.S. troops are housed. These missiles apparently destroyed some equipment. We were told a helicopter, a drone, pockmarked the airfield there, but did not cause any significant damage and did not cause any, loss of human life. And so that's the read we're getting out of people in the Pentagon. And as I said earlier, I think that is either because the Iranians purposely struck it in such a way that it would not kill people, or, it's also quite possible the Iranians tried to kill people and they just didn't succeed. Mm. And so, you know, we don't really have a clear picture yet, and I'm not sure we ever really will, of what exactly took place and what the Iranians' intentions are. But we do know the result is one that certainly is not nearly as bad as it could have been. And I think certainly people in the Trump administration are taking that as a sign that the Iranians are being very careful not to push too hard. Because quite frankly, the killing of Soleimani last week, I mean, I'm still shocked by it, to be honest, because for years we've known who this guy is. We've heard constantly how he is going across the region and arming terrorist groups all over the place and causing all of this instability. As was alluded to earlier, President Bush, President Obama were both given options to take this guy out, and they passed because they were concerned mm-hmm. about escalating too much. And the fact that we did this probably really did scare the bejesus out of the Iranians. They could be a little bit back on their heels here and not wanting to get into a huge fight with the U.S.
Right. Well, so hang on here for just a second, because on that point, let me go to Harold, who's calling from Centerville, Massachusetts. Harold, you're on the air.
Hello. Good to be on the air with you. I'm concerned that after 36 years in the military, reaching and having served on the CENTCOM staff for a short period of time, that we don't seem to have gained out the what people refer to as the unintended consequences of our actions. Usually unintended consequences are an excuse word for, oops, I didn't think about that in advance, and we sure should have. We justified this largely on the fact that Soleimani was a vicious, vile, pernicious human being, similar to the way we justified taking out, decapitating in Iraq, Saddam Hussein. What did we get out of that? We went from a relatively stable Middle East with Iran, the bigger enemy, totally pinned in U.S. forces to the northeast in Afghanistan, a then stable Turkey, mm-hmm. a Western-orientated Turkey to the west, and the Iran's biggest enemy, Saddam Hussein, to the south, to now Iran having hegemonic control over everything from Lebanon through Syria to most of Iraq and its fingers in the pie in Yemen and a number of other places. So the question is, what do we get out of this? Mm-hmm. What are the intended consequences, and have we thought through that?
And Harold, if I may, you said you served on the CENTCOM staff for a little while. You served in the Navy?
Served in the Navy for 36 years.
And retired at what rank?
Rear Admiral.
Rear Admiral, okay. Mm-hmm. So, Rear Admiral, thank you so much for your observation and your question. David Gergen, I mean, that is one of the central questions, right? And it reminds us of what lessons did we learn from Iraq? But your response to Harold.
Well, Harold and Brian earlier, I think, captured a lot of what's troublesome right now. And typically when we have gone into conflicts in the past, for better or for worse, the American people have rallied behind our president. They have believed the word of the president and the word of our defense officials, the word of the military. You know, there was a time way back in Vietnam, nobody trusted the military. Today, it's one of the most trusted institutions in the country. And yet we have now a country full of skeptics about what the administration is saying, what the administration is doing, whether they really have a grip on this. The credibility of the administration, as I keep emphasizing this, because I think it's so important when you go to war that you have the people with you. But when – just think about it, in the last few days, we were told – the question was, why do we go after him now?
Mm-hmm.
And the Pompeo and others keep telling us it was an imminent threat. They have briefed people on the Hill, and many come out of those briefings saying we don't see the evidence of an imminent threat, that it wasn't anything very different from last week or 2 weeks ago. And so skepticism has grown that this has more to do with 2020 elections than it does with protecting the security of the United States. And that weakens the capacity of the president to make things happen in our direction.
Right. Well, Brian Bender, there's a question that just sort of lurks in my mind and possibly in many people's minds. I want to ask you. To the point of why now, one of the things that we shouldn't we be asking is, I mean, look at the people that the president, his advisors that he is surrounded by, Secretary of State Pompeo, who is an adamant hawk on Iran. Now, John Bolton is no longer in the White House, but he too, I mean, just wasn't only a couple of years ago, he gave a speech to Iranian dissidents in Paris and said that, like, he wanted the Ayatollah out by 2019, so maybe he's off by a year. Iran has been on the radar from a certain very influential section of Washington for a long time. Like, is that part of the – could that possibly be part of the answer of why now, that they see an opportunity?
Well, I think there's no doubt there are and have been a series of Iran hawks very close to the president. But I also think, you know, we have to remember the context here of the last few months, you know, going back through 2019. Iran shot down a U.S. drone over the Persian Gulf. We didn't do anything about it. We sort of kicked and screamed about it, but that was about it. They, or their proxies, attacked Saudi oil facilities. They also seized several ships in the Persian Gulf. They've sort of been pushing over the line little by little over the course of many months. And as we alluded to earlier, the president has been very adamant that he's not going to be Barack Obama. He's not going to lay down a bunch of threats or red lines and then do nothing about it. So I think it's a combination of things. I think you have a bunch of Iran hawks who have gotten the president to adopt a very strong policy on Iran, pulling out of the Iran deal, stepping up sanctions, this maximum pressure campaign that they call it, basically to squeeze the mullahs in Tehran, and I guess ultimately until they collapse. I think this was an opportunity. I think people in the Pentagon, elsewhere, have wanted to take Soleimani out for years, quite frankly. And, obviously it was one of the options presented to the president, and he looked at it and said, well, let's get rid of this bad guy already. And in some ways, you could look at it as sort of a safe option because it's one person, although an Iraqi militia leader was obviously killed as well and a couple of other people in the convoy. Not to be dismissed, but it's a fairly discreet single target, a big one, and a clear message to Tehran that, okay, enough is enough. You've done all these things. We haven't done anything about it. We're doing something about it now. So I think that might explain why now.
David Gergen?
I hesitate to disagree, but listen, I think the why now has conceivably has a lot more to do with politics than we're admitting, and the administration is willing to concede here. But listen, when it was stunning to read that when they went to the president with a list of options, they intentionally included the assassination of Soleimani because they thought they could talk the president. That would make it easier. The president would draw back from that. He wouldn't want to do that. That he would want to go to some more moderate and more modest option. But by sticking that in there, and he then saw this, he like a shiny new object for him, and he seized upon it, and now we're here. This isn't the way a normal government operates. It's more usually, especially when you're plunging into the future you can't understand or can't foresee, that you do it in such a way as that it's a real risk. We know. Hopefully, everybody will back down now. Hopefully, people will put down their weapons and moderate their rhetoric, and we can get out of this safely. But look at how large a risk we are in, and the fact we don't know how this is going to turn out should give us pause.
Right. We have 2 minutes left with you, David Gergen. So my last question, I want to circle back to something you said earlier when I asked you, what should our objectives be in the region? And you said, a stable, peaceable Middle East, essentially. Yeah. And Iran's objective, as they've clearly stated, is they want the United States out of the region.
Right.
To me, this sounds like a fundamental stalemate along the lines of what North Korea wants. North Korea wants the United States off the Korean Peninsula, and they want to keep their nukes. Mm. I just wonder, is it a fundamental stalemate? Can you imagine possibly a United States not militarily involved in the Middle East at all?
Uh-huh. You can have – there are two scenarios. One scenario is Donald Trump himself has argued for a long time. He wanted to get us out of the Middle East and leave it to the
people
in the Middle
East. We'll still have all those bases there.
And since that time, he's actually increased the troop levels, not decreased them. But look, I want to say, if I might, just make one other point. And that is other nations – look at us always and say, how strong or how weak are we? How divided are we or how united are we as a people? And watching what's been going on in the United States, how paralyzed we seem in so many ways, having a president impeached, it's only natural that nations that wish us harm are going to probe and see, are there weaknesses they can take advantage? Can they do things now that they couldn't easily have done because the president's not in a position to strike back or the president's team is disorganized or whatever? I worry a lot that the Iran going over the line, as Brian said, going over the line increasingly has to do with how far they can get away with it, how far they think they can get away with it. We're seeing the same thing now with the North Koreans. Mm. You know, they're probing and trying to see. And you're going to see other countries. The Chinese are going to push on this. That's what comes when you have an administration that's weakened.
Well, David Gergen, director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and advisor to four presidents, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Brian Bender, defense editor at Politico Pro, thank you as well. We'll be right back with more voices. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are taking a look. We're trying to take a meticulous and careful look at the next best steps in the escalation between the United States and Iran. In just a moment, we're going to be joined by a retired Marine Corps lieutenant colonel and a former ambassador, U.S. ambassador to Iraq. But let's just go to our phones briefly. Let's go to Janine, who's calling from Calhoun, Michigan. Janine, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi,
I have a comment and a question. The comment is that I believe this is truly a political stunt to mask impeachment and that Trump thought the entire country would rally around him. And when there are skeptics and we are not rallying around Trump as a hero, he is attacking Democrats as fiercely as he is attacking Iranians. And my question is, what are the other countries that are supposedly our allies really saying? The Europeans finally made a joint statement yesterday, but we have not heard from Macron or Merkel personally. And what about the Chinese and Russians and Japanese? I am not really hearing a lot about what other countries are saying. Thank you.
Well, Janine, thank you so much for your call and your question. And I want to turn that to our next guests. Joining us now from Newport, Rhode Island is John Griffin. He's a retired Marine Corps lieutenant colonel. He was deployed to Iraq from 2004 to 2005. He fought in the Battle of Fallujah then. He received a Bronze Star for his service in Afghanistan in 2010. And he's a professor at the Naval War College now. Professor Griffin, welcome to On Point.
Yeah, Meghna, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate having this opportunity to talk with you and your audience.
And thank you.
Just to be clear.
Yeah, go ahead.
Right, for you and your audience, right, even though I'm a retired Marine, I work on the faculty here at the Naval War College, right, all these views expressed are purely my own, right, and they don't represent the War College, the Navy, or the Department of Defense.
point well taken, and I'm glad you said that. So hang on here for just a second, because I also want to introduce Douglas Silliman into the conversation. He joins us from Washington. He's the former U.S. ambassador to Iraq, served in that post from 2016 to 2019. Prior to that, he was U.S. ambassador to Kuwait from 2014 to 2016, and he's the president of the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. Ambassador Silliman, welcome to you.
Meghna, hello. It's very good to be here with you today.
So first of all, you heard Janine, our caller's question there from Michigan about what do our allies think of this at this moment? What have you seen so far, and how would you assess the situation from the perspective of America's relationship with its allies?
What we've seen so far from our allies and other major world players is a lot of caution. There is not a lot of trust in many of our allies in what either Tehran or Washington is going to do next. So you have seen fairly consistent calls for calm and de-escalation. What I'd like to say is, based on what I see from Iran's military response last night, we may have an opportunity to move in that direction. So if I could just lay out what I think Iran's three strategic objectives were last night. The first one was to please their own domestic audience. They had whipped up such fervor over the killing of Major General Qasem Soleimani, they had to do something. And last night and this morning, they may have done something and then closed the issue domestically, which is a potentially a good sign. Secondly, they seem to have calibrated their military steps last night so that the United States would not have to retaliate militarily, mm-hmm. so that it gives Washington the option to pause and consider things. But third, and maybe most important, they have still engaged in efforts to scare the neighborhood, to make sure that Israel, to make sure that the Gulf Arab allies of the United States are concerned about next steps and want to keep pressure on the United States to de-escalate. And frankly, those people who want to see the free flow of oil and commerce from the Persian Gulf, especially in Asia, will also still be nervous about the next steps that Washington or Tehran might take.
I see. So, John Griffin, then let's take that second part that Ambassador Silliman mentioned about Iran, you know, calibrating its military response in order to prevent or give the United States to not retaliate militarily. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with them. I think, you know, I'm grateful that at least right now there's been no reported casualties. And so, you know, we're lucky there. And I think it speaks to something that we're not really talking about, but I would offer that there's a lot of actual rational moves and rational acts happening, despite what appears to be a conflagration over the past few weeks. So whether Iran deliberately missed, which is possible, right, in order not to escalate, I think that can be supported by the fact that they contacted Iraqi officials and informed them of the attack that's coming. So I think there are some there's some rational decisions that are going on here that actually give us an opportunity, give us a tactical pause in which we can negotiate, because neither party wants to escalate. And everyone's been clear about that from the beginning.
Mm. Well, if I may ask, I mean, given your experience both in the region, in Iraq and Afghanistan, mm-hmm. can you just walk us briefly through, you know, what in terms of military options right now, what you think the best military options might be for the president?
Yeah, so I think from a military perspective, right, I think our objective has been clear, you know, for quite some time, right? Our aim is to deter further Iranian behavior in the region. And that's been, you know, for our timeline, America, we tend to look at it as 40 years. Is there a malign actor, right, who's trying to destabilize the region? But I think you see, you know, my opinion is that there's a military buildup, right, because it adds to the credibility that the U.S., you know, may use force. Because the first step in deterrence, whether it's deterrence at like an individual or group terrorist level, or if it's a nation state level, is you have to have presence, right? That's the first step in deterrence. So if we don't have a credible presence in the region, then our threats of escalation are there. But again, we haven't threatened to escalate. We're trying to de-escalate.
Mm-hmm. Well, so Ambassador Silliman, then, I mean, isn't it required to have sort of the threat of deterrence through military means go hand in hand with diplomacy in order to achieve that de-escalation? And do you see that sort of hand in hand partnership working now out of the White House?
Well, what I do see in the actions that the United States has taken over the past week and a half, the attempt to reestablish some strategic deterrence against Iranian overreaching. Many of the attacks that occurred in the Gulf, outside the Strait of Hormuz, on Saudi Arabian oil processing facilities, and the shooting down of the American drone, there was not a significant reaction in oil or financial markets. There was not a significant American political response, and frankly, there was no military response. So the Iranians may have thought they could get away with more than the Trump administration was ultimately going to let them do. One of the reasons that Iran seems to have calibrated last night's attacks to not require an American retaliation is because I think there has been a modicum of strategic deterrence restored. But let me mention maybe three strategic points that I think do come out of this that will bear on diplomacy going forward. First of all, last night, Iran introduced into this conflict ballistic missiles for the first time. Mm-hmm. They have used them in and against Iraqi targets before, but their technical capability to use them, how good they were, these are things military experts will have to determine down the road. But more importantly, the Iranians have been putting a lot of effort into their ballistic missile capability as the Iran nuclear agreement had curtailed what they could do on the nuclear side. So it is entirely possible that there is scope for negotiations and some scope to really put to bed the nuclear capability of Iran once and for all, and that is a goal that President Trump stated very clearly in this last week. So that's one possible opportunity. The second thing, the Iranians are continuing indirect threats through proxies and through the media against Arab states in the Gulf, Israel, and a little bit more broadly to international trade and commerce. These Iranian threats and the violent response that they made last night may help the administration pull together a larger group of willing friends and allies to try to contain Iran and its regional expansion. But the third point is, last night, Iran essentially claimed ownership of Iraq. They did this by attacking in Iraq, but especially the attack on coalition force base near Erbil Airport was a message to the Iraqi Kurds. Mm-hmm. The attack in Anbar province is probably a message to Iraqi Sunnis that don't get too close to the Americans because we can reach you where you live. And what we will see in the coming months, I assume, is still a contest, political and potentially with militias and militarily, inside Iraq over the soul of Iraq and the future of Iraqi politics.
I see. Well, so John Griffin, though, let me ask you. So Ambassador Silliman there seems to, if I hear you correctly, Ambassador, he seems to be laying out some potential windows of opportunity, windows of optimism here. But don't, in order to sort of capitalize on those opportunities, don't we need a kind of stability in decision-making, strategic stability, leadership stability coming out of both Washington and Tehran?
Right. So, yes. And so I think, you know, it would be easy to say that, you know, I would propose a different communication strategy than our president. I would still offer that I would put this recent conflagration on the timeline of a much longer horizon, whether you go back to 2003, 1980, or for the Iranians back to 1953. So it's scary this morning, and people are scared, and they have every right to be. But I would suggest that there are more rational actors, just like the ambassador was talking to, that people recognize that even though we're seeing a lot of military action, these are really just actions that are having an effect in the information environment. And because there's information out there, we can see an opportunity to bring partners together. We can begin to try to push back against, you know, Iranians' malign influence as they continue to build out their Shia crescent through Iraq into Syria and Lebanon, right, and encircling, you know, our allies in the south down through Yemen. So it's this competition that continues to go on, and it's not just 2 weeks old. It's a much longer time horizon, and I think we do have an opportunity because of the recent actions actually puts us in a better position for negotiation.
Your point well taken about the half century of history we're talking about here, but or more, and that also might mean we have a half century ahead of us, John. But let's go to Ali, who's calling from Detroit, Michigan. Ali, you're on the air.
Hello. I hope you're all having good days. I just got back from Iran 2 days ago, and I can tell you for a fact that Iranian people don't want any war. They don't want a war because Donald Trump wants to get reelected, or the Iranian regime wants to hang on to power. It's a dangerous situation because both governments are not popular and both governments want to be in power, so a war would maybe a good solution, but definitely not a good solution for American or Iranian people. Mm. And I really want to convey this message from Iranian people that they love Americans and we are all one people, no matter what country we're from.
Ali, let me just ask you then, when you heard of the Iranian missile strike in Iraq last night, I mean, what was your first thought? The Ayatollah called it a slap in the face to the United States.
Well, my first thing was, oh, my God, no war. I don't want any war. Mm-hmm. Iran doesn't deserve another war. U.S. cannot afford another war. So being Iranian-American puts you right in the middle of a parental war that you don't want to be in.
Mm. Well, Ali, thank you so much for your call. Ambassador Silliman, what's your thought from what Ali said?
Well, I think the basic point that he makes is that probably the populations of both countries, Iran and the United States, do not want to see a war. The real question for policymakers is how do you avoid it and how do you not get trapped in a series of increasing escalations? And I think based on what looks to be the opportunity that Iran may have provided last night with carefully calculated attacks, there is room for the Trump administration to reclaim the moral high ground mm-hmm. in this conflict. First of all, the Trump administration needs to consult with our regional allies, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Kuwait, Qatar, Oman, and the Israelis, but also European allies to make sure that they can help define what the administration's goals for the Gulf region, for Iran policy and vision going forward is. And I think this is one of the things that the Trump administration has not done particularly well up to this point, is clearly and publicly define an end state for this region. Now would be a good time to do so, and to do so in conjunction with some of our closest allies. But I also see the opportunity now to move back to some sort of multilateral negotiation. That doesn't mean going back to the old Iran nuclear agreement, but it does mean take advantage of openings that we have seen politically from Iran and the desires of our European and regional allies to create stability and conditions for more prosperity in the region, particularly in Iraq, where the struggle between the United States and Iran has really hurt the development of the country and has hurt not only the American project to develop and make Iraq a productive member of the international community, but this is the goal of the United Nations, of the European Union, of Japan and South Korea and Australia and most of the world.
Yeah.
And it has been Iranian interventionism, especially since 2003 in Iraq, that is trying to pull Iraq out of the international community and make of it a pliable Iranian mm-hmm. ally. This can be contested, not violently, but it will require international efforts.
Mm-hmm. Well, John Griffin, we've got about 30 seconds left. So I started this hour by asking David Gergen what he would advise the president now. With the point that you're not speaking for the Naval War College at all, what would you advise the president if you had his ear? We got about 30 seconds.
Sure. Yeah, I would second what the ambassador was talking about. I think that we have to realize that, it's just a few years ago we negotiated with them over the JCPOA. And whatever your opinion is, out there, it doesn't matter. Like, the negotiations happened. Go back to Afghanistan. They helped us fight some enemies over there, right? So there are opportunities to have regional discussions. Right. In the end, Iran's looking for just respect and credibility. They see themselves as a country 2,000 years old. And so regionally, I think they're a much more rational actor than we give them credit for. And I think the president ought to look to his allies and friends in the area, because we have a window where we can de-escalate all the tensions that just happened.
Well, I'm hearing the call for rational and cool heads to prevail, and I think many millions of people would agree. John Griffin, professor at the Naval War College and retired Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much.
And Douglas Silliman, former ambassador to Iraq and Kuwait as well. Ambassador Silliman, it was a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much.
It was great to be here. Thanks, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.